G'day, listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Scouting Australia podcast, powered by Australian Property Scout Buyers Agency. I'm your host, Sammy Gordon, and today, guys, we've got a little bit of a different ep. Once again, 2 weeks in a row, a little bit of a different ep, and I have the big Jimmy Ibrahim in the studio to discuss with me the road to winning Buyers Agent of the Year. Now, I want to thank you firstly to all of our loyal listeners and our loyal followers that have reached out to me and reached out to the team as well to congratulate us on winning this award. A lot of people out there saying, long time coming, it's good to finally see you pick it up. I just want to say a massive thank you first and foremost to everyone out there who has written in and reached out to us and let us know that as well. So firstly, a massive thank you on that front. Then moving on to having a big chat with Big Jimmy Ibrahim. Mate, I know you said, mate, we've got to jump on and have a bit of a chat about this. It's a massive achievement. You know, I've been chasing it for years, 4 years there as a finalist and to finally pick it up. It's been cool, man. It's been cool to finally get it. And mate, it was lovely to share the night with you and celebrate the win with you as well. So mate, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Sammy. And on behalf of all the listeners and all the APS team, congratulations to you on winning this award. Now, folks, you know Sammy very well if you've been listening to the podcast. He's usually jumping out of his skin to get into the podcast episodes, but today is a little bit coy because if you know Sammy, and I do know him well, he doesn't like the spotlight on him. And we were debating whether to do the episode. Sammy didn't want to do it, but I said, Sammy, are you serious? The people want to hear what makes the Buyer's Agent of the Year tick. And so I said to him, mate, we're going to do an episode. I'm going to ask you some questions. People want to get into the inner psyche of what makes him tick. So I appreciate you doing this episode because I know that you don't really like talking about yourself, Sammy boy, but I think the listeners will love it. And you deserve it.
Thank you, mate. Thank you. I appreciate it, man. I'm not one to normally flaunt it or walk around with the, you know, showcasing all the things I've done or won or, you know, achieved in myself as well within my own journeys. But yeah, man, I kind of feel like it could be a cool way. When you kind of ran me through how you were thinking of running the app, I thought, you know what, there'll be a lot of clients that'll probably appreciate, because so many clients have been on the journey since the very start as well, that are still obviously with us and still working with us. And there's others that are coming into the fold as well. So I think it could be a cool app, man, to give a bit of backstory around all of that as well, how it was all born and the road that kind of got us to finally taking it out.
So just to give context to people, so the REB is the Real Estate Business Awards, Australian body of real estate.
Yeah, yeah.
And our good man, Sammy Gordon, won the Buyer's Agent of the Year. So an incredible award and just reward, should I say.
Thank you, mate. No, I appreciate it.
For all of your hard work. But
I think the thing to throw in on that as well, the biggest thing, and I said it when I bloody won the thing as well, and the way I look at it is it's like it's never an individual thing. I look at like how I operate now compared to back when I was at the start and like having the team that I have now and working with them all. That's what allows me to kind of perform still at like that very elite level in terms of buying and helping and assisting clients and whatnot as well. So, mate, it's as much obviously an award for the team as it is for myself, because probably would never have won it without them as part of the journey as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I appreciate that. There is a great team backing you and you're the fearless leader. But my first question for you, Sammy boy, is you've obviously created an incredible portfolio. You're incredibly successful in what you do, at the top of your game, leading the industry in this space.
Thank you, man.
So I'm just curious, you know, you've got such a large portfolio, you've got all the toys, you're doing a lot of the things, you're living life in your own terms. So some would say you've already won. So how important is this award? I'm curious as to where does this sit for you, and how important is this in the big context of the Sammy Gordon journey?
Matt, I remember you asked me this on the night because you didn't know that that was my fourth year sitting there and the previous three not winning it. And I remember you asked me on the night, you go, mate, does it really matter? You know the quality of what we produce and that I'm very adamant that we are the best in the business at this. And you go, do you really need a trophy to say it? And I go, mate, it's not the trophy. It's the I think just like almost like the recognition side of things of how long we've been doing this and how long we've been doing this at the top of the game. And so many people have moved into the level that we operate in terms of deals and scale and the way that we perform in terms of actual deal numbers, but the quality goes. And so I've spoken to so many brokers and accountants that have been in the game for years and they go, mate, I don't know how you still retain such good quality while you're doing deals, because everyone that we see that starts going past just being a one-man band or a couple of people, they stop caring about it. They're more just about the volume. I need to pay for those overheads, all these things. And they say to me all the time about retaining and keeping the quality within it. So, man, it's one of those things. I think it's just like it's a very, very nice feather to have in the cap. And, man, it's like we like to win, right? And second place to me is a first loser. So I don't care where I come in years before, not winning is losing. And so, man, I just wanted to win it.
It's unlike you to be competitive. I just never pick that. Now, I don't know if anyone else is listening, but Sammy said very clearly he's been sitting there for the last four times, never won. Good old salty dog over here comes along to the function. And then what happens? When are you going to learn, Sammy boy? You bring me along to the party. You'll win.
It was almost like they gave it to me for, what are they?
Sympathy.
Participation award, like sympathy award. Man, this guy, someone's going to die in this room. You can smell him. He smells
quick,
like he's going to die.
Before he passes out.
Let's give him a bit of excitement in his life before he goes.
But it was good to have the team there. You had
it was amazing,
your own table, the APS team, everyone sharing
normally,
the spoils.
For the first couple of years, it was just Morgs and I that would go. And then we'd go with big, most clients would know. And obviously, listeners of Scouting Australia podcast, they'd know big Jason Titus, big JT. He'd come along with his lovely wife JL, and for the last 2 years it's just been the four of us. And I was like, I kind of had a feeling this year. I was like, man, if I can't win it this year off the years that I've had these last couple of years, like, it just doesn't make sense. It wouldn't have made sense. I was like, I was quietly confident this year of something coming our way, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to bring some of the team out, especially the guys that have been with us for a very long time, and some of the guys that are really core. So it was really cool to kind of have the team atmosphere with it. We had the full team, and it was funny because the fellow who announced the award, we know each other reasonably well, and he was just before he announced it, he opens it and he's like, he's just smiling, he's just like laughing because he knew it was like long time coming. And then he goes, yeah, this is going to be rowdy. And then he said, he called my name and we just went wild. So it was good. It was really cool. Awesome having the team there.
And in saying that, to win this award, what do you believe sets you apart, right? Because I know you don't like talking about it, but I really want to break it down. So what separates you apart from the other BAs in the industry? What do you think it is?
I honestly believe the biggest thing that sets both myself and APS apart from everyone else is I did it myself. So I've sat in the position and I've walked the walk of the kid making 80 grand, 60 grand, 80 grand a year, 36 grand a year was when I bought my first property. I've walked that walk. I know how important it is to execute at the highest level and to pick up the best deals. And I have built a portfolio out on a standard PAYG average Australian income. No one else has done that. No one else has built it to the scale or built it even before I started the buyer's agency. No one else has done it. You know, it was in the first year of business, but I wasn't doing anything. I hadn't done anything in the first year of business from a business perspective. That was the year that I won Australian Investor of the Year. I took the knowledge that I gained from all those years and obviously what I've learned since then as well. But then I applied to everyone's portfolios. And I think that the biggest thing, I see a lot of actual buyer's agents that are out there that were clients of other buyer's agents before, right? They haven't even really gone through the buying process and understood it, even if they were crap deals and that's why they got into it and all the rest of this sort of thing. It's like there's been nowhere near as much experience as to what I had to go through. I bought every deal myself and I did try and go out and I had a look at other buyers. And basically back when I was 25, 26, I think I was. I had a 7 property portfolio and I went to go with someone, and conversely, I actually got burnt because I was aware enough because I'd done enough deals of the terrible quality of deals that I was being presented. But yeah, man, it was one of those. I think they're probably the culminating factor. Like I have sat in almost everyone's shoes that sits across from me, whether they're at the absolute bottom or they're doing really, really well. I can relate to all of them, you know, across the whole board with that. And then that experience of going through and getting burnt by someone. And at the time, man, I think I was 25, 26. I was probably making 60, 70 grand a year. I burnt 10 grand, 9,990 or something like that. 10 grand. That was a huge amount. It's a huge amount of money now, but it was a huge amount of money to me back then, almost 10 years ago, making 60, 70 grand a year, like after tax, you're clearing like 50 grand. To lose 10,000 like that and never got it back. Man, it lit a ridiculous fire in my belly, but it just put me on this super, super straight moral compass, right? So like we could do a ridiculous amount of deals, right? We've built the brand, we've built everything, but it's still, we have so many quality control checks within APS before a deal ever goes to a client. We specifically match deals to clients, and that's the way that we work, and we specifically pair them up from that perspective. They don't just get to see everything, you know, and you send them, they sign on, and then within the next week, they've been sent 10 properties. We specifically hunt a property for a specific client's brief that is going to move their specific situation and their strategy forward. And when you know how to do it because you've been through it before, who else can compete with that? And when the moral compass is so straight because you've been burnt before, and you wouldn't want to do it to someone else from that end as well. Again, I don't know anyone else that's like has been through the same things as myself through that. And I know a lot of the BAs that are out there. A lot of them come from white collar and all the rest of this sort of thing. And there's nothing wrong with that. But they haven't been through the same thing as me. They have to hustle for it. They have to grind and negotiate like a dog for every dollar the whole way through the process, like I had to do the whole way through. But my first property on 36 grand a year. There's not too many people that can say that. It took me 3 years to save my first deposit at 19. Very, very small number of people that can say that. And then went through and learnt it all as I went. And that's what they get to work with, man. And I think that's the, to me, those things are, is the core values, right? And really what emulates what we're doing at Australian Property Scout. And while we're so committed to our goals as well, in terms of what we're trying to help clients with as well, it's not just like, we don't just throw these things away. They're throwaway comments. They're things we're literally like 100% committed to. And if a client isn't committed on board with that, we don't really want to work with them. We want the ones that are committed to achieving their goals and going hard after them as well.
So you're saying basically that it's a lot easier to really build out a fast portfolio and a large portfolio once you're making a significant amount of income from a business.
Yeah, of course.
So before your business really started to take shape, and how many properties did you actually like value, and how many, the number of properties?
That I had in my portfolio?
Yeah, as an individual investor before you then went hard into...
So I started the buyer's agency in 2019, at the start of 2019. That was the year that I also won Investor of the Year. But I didn't actually do, I think I had done 2 or 3 clients by the end of 2019.
Maybe in a whole year?
In a whole year. Yeah, wow. it was because I was still working at the same time. I was still working on the farm at the same time. Yeah, so the first year was almost nothing. And in that year, I hit 20 properties. So I wanted to buy 20 properties before I turned 30, so while I was still in my 20s, and I hit 20 properties in that year.
Okay. That's impressive. Kind of, I mean, 20 as a retail investor.
Yeah.
That's a pretty incredible number. I didn't know that was the 20 was before you actually started the business.
Yeah. Well, it was in the I had started, but it hadn't taken off. You know, it was like that first year of infancy that most people go through that's normally terrible, especially when you don't go all in.
Yeah.
And then that's when I kind of made the decision. I'd done really well out of some cash flow deals, and I'd gotten myself to about 60 grand passive like the year before, and I traveled in 2018. And then in 2019, that's when I started the business. But then I was a bit haphazard. I still did a bit of traveling. I wasn't taking it seriously. I was still investing seriously, and I did a couple of deals. I did a couple of unit blocks, did a house and grannies and stuff like that. And I supercharged my cash flow. And so then I put my cash flow to over 100 grand a year net passive that year in 2019. And then that's when I won Investor of the Year. And I was like, fuck this, I'm going all in. I'm going to go all in on this thing and just go as hard as I can. And so I left work. I'd given them a big long notice period, left work, went all in. And the rest is history.
Mate, that's pretty impressive. And can you take us back to the first year? Because it's great now, you won the award and all that. But what was it like for the people that don't really know your story? Starting out as a BA, what was that like?
See, the hardest thing was when I got into years like 2 and 3, and things started to really take off, and I was with I was competing against other buyers agents, big names, right? Big names, people that you would expect to be really good. And I remember I kept losing clients to these big names, and then I'd go and compete with them. And I remember, because I laughed, because Nick Wilcox, who's been on this podcast as well, big client of ours, especially very early on, went very hard. I remember he brought me this deal that another buyer's agent, big name buyer's agent, had bought him in the street behind. He paid $318,000, they knocked $1,000 off, whoop-de-doo. And so he paid $317,000 for this property. It was on 450 square meters, and it was in average condition, right? It was very similar house, but it was in average condition. He said, if you can beat this deal, he goes, mate, I like you. You're young, you're hungry, all the rest of it. If you can beat this deal, mate, I'll just keep investing with you. You got me for life. I'll keep doing it. Because he thought that was an okay deal. So he went the street behind and 3 doors down. And I negotiated this deal for him at $280,000 that was on a 600 square meter corner block compared to his 450 square meter standard lot. And the house was substantially bigger and in much better condition than the one that he paid for 317. And so it's more than, it was more than 10% discount on that front. He had it valed 3 months later. So we bought another deal after that one. But he had that valed 3 months later at like 345 or 355 or something like that from memory. And it was 6 months after the other one. So the market had actually moved a little bit and we bought it more than 10% cheaper. And then he had the, you know, the considerable uplift. I think the big difference between the other one and this one, the biggest thing was the house was actually bigger. It was quite nice. There was an area where they developed a lot of very similar homes and there was a few that were like owner-occupied built that were a bit bigger and a bit nicer, a bit classier. That was one of these ones. So it was crazy to get it for that money. And that was in 2020. He just sold that, I think, for like five. So we paid 280. I think he just sold it for high fives, almost 600 grand in 3 years.
He
sold it in the back
deal.
End of last year.
Nick too, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. So yeah, just
That's
over three
incredible.
Years, he more than doubled his money on that thing. So... yeah, man, like I kind of look at it and I look at these other guys that are out there and that was my biggest issue. Sorry, we've kind of gone like a whole,
but to
bring this thing right back to round, like whole circle as to where we kind of started with that is I was competing against those guys who had a huge name, but there was no quality. And so what I just focused on was just like, I just got to keep focusing on my quality and it'll come. And I'll get a few people referred and I'll get a few from here. And I got a few clients off being Investor of the Year and people starting to notice who I was as well. And then it just really started to kind of snowball from there. The quality was the biggest thing. At APS, we do about 60% of our clients every month are repeat or referred clients. Show me another buyer's agency in Australia that does 60% repeat or referred clients. You know what I mean? We don't advertise.
Mm. That's a big one.
We're doing 60% repeat and referred clients every single month, month in, month out. No one else competes with that. You don't get that unless you're doing excellent deals. Mm. Clients are getting excellent results. They're coming back around and they're referring friends and family. You don't get that if you're not doing an amazing job. And I never intended the business to really come from that angle and to be built around that. But it's the quality that we just continually produce on that front. Again, I go back to like the little stop points and little checkpoints that we have the whole way through the process to make sure that the deals are continually at top notch. When you do that, when you hold true to that and when you do not sway or waver from that, the clients come. They come anyway, you know what I mean? So it's, it's been cool because that first year was brutal. The first year was brutal. I'd have meetings with people and I didn't realize how bad these other agencies were at the time and I'd be always losing them to them and they'd go to them and I'd just be like, oh yeah, fuck, they are good. Like, you know, it's hard for me to compete. So I'd start cutting my fees to try and get some of these guys on board. And then when I started doing deals and seeing how bad they were, then it just fired me up. And I was like, nah, this is bullshit. So I started going harder, put my fees up, went harder, and then it started to snowball from there. So it's, it was a funny evolution, man. It was... There's so much there that like people look at where I am now and you know Alex Hormozy?
Yes.
Yeah, the game.
Yes.
So I remember listening to a podcast with him just the other day and he's like, it's funny because people root for the guys who don't need it and they don't root for the ones that do. And when you're doing really well, everyone's like, yeah, man, you're killing it. And it's like now I look at it and I love the community that we have and what we've built and how many people really love what we do and are behind us. But when I was like down there and just willing to do whatever I could for a client on that front. It's funny, man. Like there was no one rooting, you know, like it's a soul journey.
Well, let's tap into that a little bit. Cause I know you don't like talking about this stuff as much, but can you just give like the challenges and the sacrifices that you made? Like now you are one of the most competitive people that loves to win.
Yeah.
And when you're not winning, those sacrifices and challenges that you face, right? Can you just give us a bit of an insight into that and how that's actually shaped you for where you are today?
Mm. The sacrifice and challenge through the whole journey or just
especially at the start. Yeah, at the start, you know, that's shaped you, you know, starting your business, but also to get you to this point. How do you think they have?
I think it's a constant rejection. So when you start, there's a big thing. And I grill people before I hire as well, just being like, how much rejection can you handle? Like how strong are you? And you can normally tell by the way people... They can look you dead in the eyes and tell you you're dead straight or they can or they can't. And what I've always found, the people who work the best are people who can handle the rejection because in our space, not only do you cop a huge amount of rejection from clients for a multitude of reasons, but then also you get rejection from agents and everything trying to do deals. And it's a very rejection-heavy business, you know what I mean? Mm. And so for me, when I first came in, cutting my teeth on it, it was such a different – because I knew how to invest. I knew how to buy. I knew how to make money from deals. I'd done well researching and putting money into the correct areas and doing really well from all that and applying a lot of different strategies. But I think that rejection piece is the hardest piece. And getting through that at the time as well – didn't have a partner. I didn't have any misses or anything. I did not have the most supportive family in the world, to put it simply. Mm. I was really on the journey by myself. But I think the mental fortitude I built up over all the years of playing sport, I don't like to lose. I was just like, I just got to keep doing it. It'll pay off. I've got to keep doing it. It'll pay off. It was funny though, because I'll say, like, at the end of the first year, I was like, I'm going to have a good run at this for like the next like 3 to 4 months. If it doesn't pan out, maybe this isn't for me, because I was thinking about going down the building route, but I was struggling to crack against the big boys that were really doing well. They were just such a big name, and I was just really struggling from that front. And it wasn't so much that I was quitting. I was just like, I'm not sure if I can actually do this, because I'd never done business. I'd never done sales. Never been in real estate or anything like that. I literally was a farm boy who just built a mad portfolio. I knew what I was doing from that end. So I had always, my game plan was always like, I'm going to trial this thing for a year. If it doesn't work, I'll go get my builder's license and start developing my own projects. So then that started kind of percolating in the back of my mind. But then, man, everything clicked. And I'm so glad it did, because like, whilst I would love to develop my own projects, and like I love that I get to do that now anyway, right? I just don't build it myself. But yeah, man, it's one of those things that like, I'm so glad that I followed through and kind of got to the level I did. But it's a lot of pushing, man. Some people can cut it, they can't.
But was it your grunt work to push and to break through, or was it the fact that you weren't 100% committed, and then there was a tipping point where you just had no option to fail?
My biggest issue probably with starting the business was I had done well in property, so I had a passive income stream coming, right? So have you ever heard the Arnie expression of burn the boats?
Mm.
I almost needed to burn the boats, because I had a fail-safe plan, you know what I mean? And that's what kind of, for me, I was like, oh, well, I'm still working. So I still got some money coming in, and I've got like 60, I was like 70 grand a year passive coming in from the portfolio. So it wasn't like a do or die, make or break sort of situation or something. I can't remember who it was, but someone said to me, oh, when are you going to like, what are you going to do? When are you going to like do something else? I can't remember. It's probably someone in family or something. Like, are you going to, you know, because I'd been talking about doing the building stuff as well. And that's when I was like, nah, you know what? Like, I know I'll do all right at this thing. I know how to do all this. I just need to get the clients. Once I get the clients, we'll start rolling from that end. And that's when I think I just really committed to it. And that's when I said, I can't remember exactly what it was. It's 3-4 months. And I go, I'm going to go all in on this thing for the 3 to 4 months. I'm just going to and do whatever I can to get clients. Even if at the time I was cutting stuff to get them in, but just to get a few runs on the board to get my confidence in there. And you know what was the funniest thing though? The clients I did end up signing on was the ones I wasn't cutting my fees for. It was the ones that like saw the value when I went and sat down with them and had the conversation. I used to do discovery. It wasn't a call. I used to get discovery sessions. I'd drive around Sydney and sit down with people and have sessions and that. And yeah, man, it finally kind of cracked through. And it was hard, man. 100% it's hard. Like when you start out business, it's one of those things. I look at now people trying to come in now compared to back then. The issue back then, there wasn't as many small players as there are now. So like I feel like there's a very big saturation at the moment at the very bottom end. There's a lot of all these people coming through trying to have a crack at it, thinking it's easy. And so many of them don't have any experience. And I would be a little bit worried about trying to compete against that bottom level at the moment, because there's just so much of that. But then the biggest issue now as well is there are some big players, obviously like Australian Property Scout. There are some very big players that have a lot of market share, but when you look at Australian Property Scout, we're big, but the quality's still so good, but we charge like the same as everyone else. So why would you go in there? Because we're not trying to like scalp everyone and try and make as much as we can sort of thing. It's quality, but it's also like, I feel weird charging like top end fees to kids, right? So we have the first time a discount and stuff like that. And it's funny, you see so many people coming through sort of trying to charge the same money, but they've got no experience. They've got no like base and everything, but they're trying, you can't compete. Mm. You can't compete with the best in the business that charge the same money that have that quality and have those runs on the board. And that's me just being brutally honest about it. And if I came in right now and tried to compete against myself, I would just be like, fuck, like, good luck. You know what I mean? Like it would be very, very hard.
So you think there's some of them are trying to fake it by putting these high prices, trying to make them look like a premium product, but they don't have the substance behind it to justify
that's what you charge in the industry. A lot of people that's a going rate a lot of the time, what we charge on our bottom end for our service. And yeah, man, so there's a lot of people kind of having a crack at that sort of thing. But there's a massive saturation there. I didn't even think about it. I never think about it. You bringing it up is what makes me talk about it. But I never think about it because, again, you look at the repeat and the referred business that we do. We don't advertise. And everyone listening to this, because you're a property person, you probably look at realestate.com and you listen to this stuff, the algorithms would target you with all the other guys that advertise. You would know that you never see Australian Property Scout on a sponsored post. And that's because we don't need to from that front. We have enough organic. We get a bit off this, obviously, and then we obviously have the repeat and referred clients. So I never have a worry about what's coming through, you know, from that perspective as well. And when you're doing the right thing all the time, you never have to worry. It's people doing the churn and the burn, and they're spending 100 grand a month on advertising, or like some of these other big players. Mm. They need to churn and burn because they need to cover the overheads, you know.
Speaking of clients, right, as a buyer's agent, everyone's wanting a great deal, right?
Yeah.
So how do you balance the expectations of a client with what's actually happening in the market, or like the conditions or their serviceability, or everyone's got all these grand plans. How do you manage that for the clients, their expectations, to ensure you do deliver on that?
We always tell people what we can realistically achieve, and discounts these days are smaller than they were two, three years ago, because the market's so tight, stock is so tight. The whole reasoning behind the super boom, what is creating a boom essentially, is everything that's creating stock, massive stock shortage. The super boom is going to come when the interest rates drop, right? So very long run kind of growth sort of coming in. But man, I think like, the discounts are relevant to the markets. So there's some markets where we can get bigger discounts, some markets where they're smaller. So it's always relevant on that front. Man, we're just always up front with what we're going to be able to produce. We never overpromise and then try and under deliver on that front. One of the big things that's actually been a bit disappointing is there was a couple of other buyers agents out there in the market that I had respect for. And then we've seen them doing deals in the last 6 to 12 months, and they've stopped trying to actually do good deals. They're paying market value or above, and I hate that. My whole idea of a buyer's agent, unless someone is actually so time poor it's not funny, that they can't go out there and physically do the work, but even then, if you're paying a fee, you know, that, how are you not getting at least a little bit of a discount? 5, 10, 15 grand, something like that, at least. You know what I mean? And there were some of these big players and I used to compete with these guys like 3, 4 years ago in Brizzy. And it was hard, man. They were good. There was two guys in particular that was good. There's one guy in particular I'm thinking of. He was good, man. Like he was back then, probably a start. He was at least at my level, maybe even a tiny bit better because he'd been doing it for a while. So he was very, very good. And then we started getting a little bit. I noticed I started getting better than him. I started getting more deals, better relationship. He started getting really big. He tries to get on everything he can. You see a lot of him. And then, in the last like 12 months, we've had multiple deals where we were just super quick and we told clients we have to have his contract in like tonight, and we'd get a contract in at like, for argument's sake, 470, and then his contract would come in the next morning or the next day at some point at 500. And we were valuing the deal at 500, you know, and we'd have it at 470, 475, 480, something like that. And his contract would come in on where we valued the deal. So it was just funny, man, to see. It's not funny. It's disappointing to see that. In my opinion, the only competitors that were left that were actually genuine hustlers are gone. I don't see anyone else that hustles the way that we still do for discounts. You know, so while we have to keep that in check to an extent, like the old days of like 40 grand below market and stuff like that, they're so rare to get those sort of discounts sort of thing anymore. Even like 30 grand these days, it is a serious push to get to that sort of level. Not to say that we don't always push for that level. But yeah, man, we've got to be realistic with people's expectations on where they are. But we still consistently produce 20 to 25K. If people are wanting really fast deals, you know, maybe they've got a quick turnaround, slightly cheaper fee, you know, we'll do deals 10 to 15 grand below. Still great deals, lot faster, good quality. You know, you're still in great markets, but obviously they're getting that little bit of discounts and not pay the premium as well. So
I get that, but I was going to ask you, how do you then manage?
Yeah.
You've got a client that started off with you buying properties at 40K below market for the first few deals, five deals, handful of deals. Market conditions change now.
The 40Ks were rare, but even the 40Ks
back then.
Let's just
say 30K.
Okay, below, 30K, right? Yeah, yeah.
And today, with markets being very different, have you ever found there's been a bit of conflict with people thinking, well, Sammy, you're not doing the same deals as you used to do?
I find it easier because I can have a candid chat with those guys. I've been working with those guys for so many years. I'm just like, mate, or whatever. I was going, yeah, mate, it's market's extremely tight. You want to buy at this price point. This is probably the best discount we'll get you. Which trademark deals at the moment, but 20, 25,000 below market. It could be more, but that's the ballpark you want to look at, you know, if you want to get a deal in a realistic time frame. If they want like the 30K plus, realistically, you know, you're going to be waiting a lot longer than the standard wait times. And in that time, the market's probably moved beyond it. So we might get you there 30, but the market might've jumped an extra 20. You know what I mean? Like if they're waiting that long from that perspective. But man, I find almost everyone is very understanding of it. Like at the moment out there, stock is ridiculously tight. You know, you're trying to buy a sub $500,000, it is on fire. There's no stock. All markets are red hot. There's a million buyers agents out there trying to, you know, fucking calling everyone sort of thing. And there's a million other investors out there trying to have a crack as well. It all comes down to having access, the correct access to get the correct deals. But yeah, man, it's I actually don't have I very, very rarely have any issues around that because we set the parameters early and people have understanding. And yeah, when someone's been with us long enough as well, they also understand that if I get them a great deal at 20, 25 under and we buy in the correct marketplace, if they bought with me 3 years ago, think of Nick Wilcox's story, like they're probably almost doubled their money on deals they bought 3 years ago. So the value has always been in our ability to pick growth markets. And I don't tout myself as being some data nerd and some location expert and all the rest of it, but look at the runs on the board. They're pretty well unmatched, you know? So, man, when we're talking 5-10 grand difference on a discount side of things, but then getting into a solid market, getting the uplift from the growth side of things, a growth market will always do 80-90% of the heavy lifting of a portfolio, you know? So, yeah, man, I don't have those issues.
Have you ever thought about pulling the pin on this? I'm just like jumping the gun here because I see you dealing with such a large amount of people and everyone wants a piece of you, and you've clearly created an incredible business, but you've got a great portfolio. If there's ever a time to put the feet up, it would be now.
Yeah.
So, you know, the clients that you're dealing with, and I know some clients may be more challenging than others. It's just human nature.
Of course.
But has there ever come a point where you go, you know what, this is not worth it?
I've probably never gotten to the point where I would fully go, this isn't worth it. Sometimes, like, I lose my shit. And when
that's unlike you.
When I lose my shit and I go crazy, people know about it, right? But if someone pushes me to the point where I lose my shit, they're done. They're done as a client. I never want to fucking see him or hear from him again. It's as simple as that. I'm very protective of my headspace these days. If something is genuinely an issue, if we have genuinely made a mistake or something bad has happened that needs to be handled and managed, bang, I'm straight on it. I'm always happy to handle something if it's a genuine complaint. But if someone wants to try and push me to the limits, it's pretty easy. You're going to find that pretty quick and you're not going to be working with us. And the beauty of, I think, what we have built is we have earned the right to pick and choose who we work with. Exactly what you're saying, I haven't needed to do this for fucking 3 years. You know what I mean? Like realistically, I haven't needed to do this, but I love doing this. I'm committed to this. Like I made a commitment 12, 18 months ago, whatever it was, to retire 500 people by 2030. That's as an absolute minimum how long I'm staying to, unless I retire them before 2030. But like that's what the game plan is, right? As an absolute minimum, that's the time frame that I have that I'm going to do this. But ultimately, man, I love it. I love the hustle. And I've probably never come close to the point of pulling the pin. You get days, man. Everyone gets days. It doesn't matter who you are, what you do. You get days where you jack of it. But sometimes you just need to walk away and come back the next day and then handle things. But man, I find that if there's people that are very unrealistic with expectations and very unrealistic, which again, occasionally happens, you might get one out of 50 people, you know, that might be like that. Man, the easiest way that we typically do is we just cut them and move on. It's the easiest way to operate these days because we don't need the clients. If someone wants to be a punish, I can see you later. It's all good. So if anyone's listening to this and they plan on being a punish, fuck off. Don't inquire. I don't want you as a client.
Do you have any recommendations where they could contact any other advice?
Where's the bottom of the file? I'll give you the number of the BA that burnt me. He's fucking great.
Selling
housing commission unit blocks and stinging you proper. Jeez. Enjoy that one.
Surely not. Is that what they're doing?
We did the fucking podcast 3 weeks ago. And
which leads me to my next question. So what do you think is the biggest misconception for that people have actually with a buyer's agent? What do you think it is?
Because the biggest misconception.
Yeah, like they obviously, some people's expectations are out of line or different. So what do you think people's misconception is about the service?
That's a great question. We don't cop too many people that are too much of an issue anymore. You know what I mean? Like it's pretty clean across the board. Some people come with unrealistic expectations, but we're good at what we do is realign the expectations. If that's where their expectations are, we essentially will take it elsewhere. Like, even just let them go sort of thing. If it's not in line with what they wanted, that's up to you, mate, to qualify them correctly on the front end. But we very, very rarely have issues with that of people coming in. Sometimes we need to put people into check. If they're carrying on and they expect you to handle every single thing to do with the deals, and we'll manage something through to settlement, but then, blowing you up after it or something for anything. And Yeah, man, I think like realistically, everyone's pretty good. We don't get too many. People aren't realistic. I normally pull them in the line pretty quick. Mm. Man, we are out there to do an exceptional job for people. We're always pushing to an exceptional job. What people have to realize sometimes, if they want like a 20, 25, 30K below market value deal, a lot of the time, even if we're putting a little bit of money into it and we're including or excluding that from the uplift side of things, if they want a discount like that, a lot of the time, you know, we have to do a little bit. It might not be much. It might be a bit of a cosmetic facelift, 3, 5, 10 grand. Probably if there was one thing that people come in, they have, you know, thinking it's going to be an owner-occupied style home, 30 grand below market. I think it's not going to happen because there's so much demand on that side. So there's always ways that we get excellent deals. But, man, like quite honestly, man, we don't cop too much of that side of things. And if it comes in, it goes out pretty quick. If someone wants to, you know, be a serious problem on that end, again, I just found the easiest way to protect my headspace and the headspace of the team so we can all keep operating properly, give the person a good deal and then, mate, good luck on your journey. It's all good.
So when you first started the business, you clearly wanted clients, right? So you'd do anything to keep them.
Actually, one thing, sorry, before you go into that, one thing is when people have an issue with on markets. So we are extremely good at defining market value, right? I would have valued probably 10,000 deals. Yeah. We're very, very good. We typically sit between 90 to 95% per month off market. Just because a deal comes through on market, it doesn't mean that it's not a good deal because we may have negotiated a correct price. There may be someone who's urgently listing and selling it at the correct price. And maybe we jag it at the correct price because of our terms, as opposed to higher offers that might be looser terms. And that's probably the only thing that we see come through sometimes is that 5% of stock that will 5 to 10% a month that does get done on market. People being like, oh, I expect it to be off market or I can see the price or whatever. And they see the price and sometimes it's the price. This is extremely rare, but there's value in at that money. And I've said this to people before. Sometimes something's been listed at offers over $499 and I've paid $550. They're like, what do you mean? And it's like someone priced it ridiculously low. I had no idea of the area. And the 550 was still excellent value. And I'm talking about for my own portfolio. I bought things on market 10% above what they were listed at because they were underpriced. And it all depends, man. It's all relevant. Just because something's on market doesn't mean it's a bad deal.
I suppose the same misconception is just because it's off market, very true, doesn't necessarily mean it's a great deal also. So that's part of the education.
Yes, I agree with you, man.
So what would you say you do differently now, Sammy Boy? 5 years into the game compared to where you started, apart from maybe conditioning clients and to understand expectations, what do you think you do differently?
Probably the only thing I really do differently, I'm still extremely active, still extremely involved. I get up at 5 a.m. I literally work for 3 hours. I'll go smash out a gym sesh. I'll come back. I normally work until about 8 o'clock every night. Like I still work really bloody hard. And I just work on different things now. But I'm very, very protective of bad apples sort of coming in. Client side of things.
The negative energy stuff, right?
And people causing issues and dramas. And when that stuff comes in, that's probably where exactly I think as you were leading in before, at the start you want to look after everyone, trying to help everyone and all the rest of it. Mate, the amount of clients, I wouldn't say the amount of clients. I'd probably only say there's 5 clients. I'd be able to count on one hand clients I still remember their names from 2, 3, 4 years ago that I wish I had the same personality I have now. And, oh, mate.
Do you want to give them a shout out? Oh.
There's a couple I'd love to do a lot more than that with. But it's, man, this is the thing. Like it's a very small number. And I think these days I'm just very cutthroat with it. If it's not a good fit, let's just move on. You know, we don't need it. You don't need it. It's all good. Let's just move on. We'll service our great clients the correct way. I think that's probably the biggest difference, man. And I think when you have that attitude, people back off because they're like, oh, well, they're very confident in what they do. They don't care if I'm a client or not. We do. We obviously care. But if someone was to be a dickhead, I don't want you on the books. So I think that's probably just the biggest way. I hope I'm not coming across like a dickhead by saying it like this. But I think it's just like I'm very protective of headspace and of punished clients. And yeah, man, that's probably the biggest change now. Because back then you just try and sign on everyone.
I think it's actually quite refreshing, to be honest, because in a world where everyone's trying to be something to everybody, you don't know your true worth.
Yeah.
And I think with you, because you're not desperate for the clients or the business per se, you can be selective. And by being selective, it just means is that you're just managing your energy and your headspace and working with people that you want to work with.
And it allows me to perform better.
And so there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So clearly that's a great sign. I think that's an incredible position to be in.
I think the coolest thing about it is like the less headaches you have, the more great work you can do for the clients that deserve it and want you for it as well. You know, I'd prefer to have 10 clients that love you and they want to do, you know, 10 deals in the next 10 years. So, yeah, you prefer 10 clients like that than 100 that are complete headaches. If I had that, I'd shut up the business. It wouldn't be worth my time to do it. And I think that's the cool thing, man, like having that.
So and there are incredible number of really grateful people. I mean, clients or people, regardless of their clients. I mean, the people that come on and they're so grateful for the difference that you've made to their lives. I mean, that's what juices, I know that's what juices you up. And for those that don't know, and I know we've said this on the podcast before, when Sammy buys a property, you won't even know about it. He puts more attention into filling up his glass of water than if he actually buys a deal, because you're a bit blasé about doing it for yourself. But if you're buying a property for a young client or someone who's been struggling or someone's getting ahead or someone's kicked ass, you're all about it and you get up and you get excited. And that's what clearly juices you up.
Yeah, 100%. Right?
So that's the engine that's driving you.
You know what I love as well? Like probably one of the biggest things is and we have it in the teams, like in the BA chat and everything, like or actually even in the team chat, when someone sends in like something so nice and they're just like so thankful, they send through the equity gain that they've just had revalued and like, oh my God, man, thank you so much. It's up. Yeah, we had one the other day. It was up 119 grand in like 8 months or something like that from a 200 and something thousand dollar property. Some ridiculous gain, right? And they just write through so thankful. We all shoot them into the team chat because it's just like, it's so mad to see. And it's funny because like, they're the people you just want to keep helping, you know what I mean? Not just because they have the big win, but it's because they're so thankful as they go through. And when people are super thankful on settlement and everything as well, they're really appreciative of the way everything goes through. Man, it gives you a lot of it keeps a drive there, you know. It keeps you, if it was a punish every day, mate, I wouldn't do it, you know, I wouldn't still be doing it. And that's the thing is love it.
You've got an incredible day. I mean, if you're starting up, you're up early, obviously, you know, 5 a.m. ish, and then you're working till late. How do you balance that with your clients? I mean, in terms of your workload?
It's kind of a balance because like these days I predominantly work with existing clients rather than incoming clients. And so as clients kind of level up within the business and their portfolios get bigger, that's when I typically start working with a lot of them. So I work with a lot of existing clients. It's really easy. I've been working with so many of them for 2, 3, 4, some of them 5 years. So when I have a chat to them, it's like having a chat with a mate. You know, they've had so many wins and they've got so much equity and we're strategizing, okay, well, you're at 6 properties, you want to get to 10 by the end of the year, this is how we do it. They're working with our brokers or our accountants and all the rest of it. And it's just like, it's a very, very easy chat and an easy way to do it. But man, I just break up what I do relative to what needs to be done. So like, I love doing these. I put some time aside to kind of plan eps out coming up. Obviously put the time aside to do the episodes. I do location research, I do strategy, reviews on the other guys as well and kind of work through their stuff too. Did training, a lot of training internally within the business. So there's just heaps of things that I do from that perspective. But the client facing side for me, it's almost predominantly all existing clients that have been with us for a while. And it's funny because like that's kind of like where they get to level up and work with me closely on that front. I love it. It's good.
Your success professionally has been pretty substantial at the age of 34. I'm curious, how do you balance that out with your personal life and your health, like your well-being, mental health?
Yeah.
You know, because sometimes business can take over everything.
Yeah.
How do you balance that with having a life outside of this?
Yeah. Sometimes it's a struggle, man. Like sometimes it's a struggle when you're so consumed by the work side of things. But I try and give myself most weekends off or at least the Sundays. So every second week I might work a Saturday. Every other week I'll have the whole weekend off. Because during the week, man, I'm just like on the whole time. Like I kind of said, I'll work from 5 in the morning till pretty much 8 at night with a couple of little breaks in there. But I train every single day. So every single morning I train without fail. I have to do it. I can work in the morning at a reasonably creative level. I normally do. That's why I work early where my phone's not blowing up. And then normally about 7:30, 8 a.m., I'll head to the gym and just smash a gym for an hour. And then I'll do a bit of ice bath, sauna, all the rest of stuff, get back for the first meeting at 9. So by that time, I've done 2.5, 3 hours worth of work. I've done a gym sesh and sauna and ice bath. And then by 9 a.m., when most people are rolling in and starting work, I've already got 3, 4 solid hours under my belt in the morning. And then I can hook into everything for the day side of things. So man, I've got a pretty good balance from that perspective. I train every day. And then when it gets to the weekends, then I can kind of plan a few different things around that as well. So, yeah, man, I also put travel breaks in there too. So typically I try and travel 3 to 4 times a year. So sometimes I just head away for 1-2 weeks. But they're my little recharges. So I try and charge up as much as I can over the weekend. But then, yeah, man, I put my little travel recharges in there because I've always loved to travel. I get around a fair bit. Love to see new places, do new things, experience new things. Love food, love drink, love travel, man, love beaches. So, yeah, I like to, that's my little way of recharging. So it's funny because some people are like, man, some people when I went to Japan, I was saying I was going to Japan or something, people are like, man, you're on holidays all the time. One of my mates that like I do a bit of work with as well, I go, what are you talking about? And he goes, man, I swear you were like last month. You were in like Fiji, New Zealand, wherever it was. I go, I was in fucking August or July or something. I go, mate, we're in December. What are you talking about? And he goes, oh, man, I feel like it was just the other day. And like I got more booked in this year because like I needed to book it in because I kind of burnt myself out. I was getting school or property ready and I just went for like 4 months straight. I was just, man, I worked almost like 7 days a week on that at that schedule to get that thing done and out. Because I knew if I didn't do it, it would take me another year and I probably still wouldn't finish it. So I just had to commit to doing it. But yeah, man, the little recharge is the key. I say it to everyone in the team as well. Like I push people like, yeah, quarterly. If you quarterly, you can take a week off. Or if you want to take an extended one at some other piece, then take yourself a little long weekend, little 3-4 day. I recharge the batteries. I always remember, man, when I used to work on the farm, there was nothing better than the Easter long weekend. You get a 4-day long weekend. You're like, oh my God, this thing's the best. So I try and encourage that sort of thing to the team as well. I probably should just do a little bit more of it myself.
What does Sammy Gordon do on a Sunday? I've always been curious. Your phone's blowing up all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What does a day off for you actually really look like?
Mate, it's a funny question. It depends on the day. If it's a great day, I'll go to the beach. I'll just chill out. I normally try and
recharge.
It's
always a great day up here. What are you playing to?
Oh, it normally comes down to a recharge. So I might get the Ferrari out and I'll go take the Ferrari out. I'll go, you know, drive up to Tambourine Mountain or down to Byron or something like that. Go get a nice dinner, a nice lunch somewhere and just like, have a nice Sunday like that. But man, most of the time I'm just kind of recharging. When I work in my blocks, I'm very, very focused. I've barely drunk this year. Since I got back from Japan, I've barely drank. I think I've drunk once, I think, since then. So I try and stay very, very focused during my work blocks before I have my little spat when I go and my little spell where I go for away for a week or two sort of thing. So man, I just try and recharge. I just recharge, do my thing.
Turn the phone off?
Nah.
Because you're getting messages literally every 5-minute block.
I normally don't get messages on a Sunday. Most people are respectful enough. They don't hit me up on a Sunday.
Okay, there's rare. A clue for everyone. Do not.
Oh, fuck, I'm not replying to you. You message me on Sunday. I'll probably reply to you next Saturday because you message me on a Sunday. But yeah, man. Nah, most people are pretty good. I don't hear much on a Sunday.
Okay.
But yeah, man. It's just all about recharge. So I recharge the batteries. All that sort of stuff.
Well, I've only got a couple more questions for you, and I know this episode's been a little bit different to our normal stuff, but I like it because you know you can talk about numbers and all that, but I think getting to know you on a different level is what people are more interested in.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm more curious if we were to look back on the journey, whether it's you know, from starting the buyer's agency or back at school or whatever, what do you think is the most valuable lesson that you've probably learnt about life?
Ever.
Essentially, and your experience in, you know, since working in property, right? Mm. But what do you think's been the most profound thing that
out of everything?
That you've learnt from yourself.
Yeah, I think I got a pretty clear one. I reckon this would have to take the cake. Don't give a fuck about anyone. Just do you. Don't fucking care about anyone. You got goals, chase your goals. Someone's got a problem with them, fuck them off. Something you really want to do, go for it. You want to build a portfolio, people try and tear you down, either fuck them off or don't tell them anything. That's what I had the biggest growth in my life when I started to be happy for other people, success, and when I stopped caring about anyone else's. So I'd see other people doing really well and I'm like, I used to have issues with it. Like I used to be bad, right? Comes from where I'm from, sort of background. But changing that mindset, I don't know if it's a lesson, it would be a lesson. Man, that was the biggest game changer for me. When I started being happy for other people, when I started being happy for other people's success and just blocked everything else out and just focused on my own journey, that was it. Game over. Done. That's where I've gotten to, both from a portfolio perspective, stop caring about other people's opinions, stop telling other people. That was the biggest thing. I stopped telling other people what I was doing. I just did what I did. And from the business side of things as well, just didn't take notice. Focused on what I knew I was going to be able to do well. It's like this year, when I kind of plan out my year in business, I normally try and plan things in quarters, but I plan the year as well. I don't really look that much at what other people are doing that's good. Maybe I should reflect on what some other people are doing that's good. I probably could do a little bit of that. But I'm more focused on what does really work for us, and I just double down on it. Where do we have a lot of success from the buying side? Where are we making mistakes internally and or how could I fix things to make them better? I'm just always analyzing, reviewing, finessing, doing things like that. Mm. That's the game changer, man. And I think it's just like you got to be very comfortable with who you are as a person and just not care about anyone else's opinion.
So that's keeping a real narrow focus.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Man, it was like when we did the potty on the APS summit, right? And I spoke about if you've been struggling to get your partner on board or something, come to the APS summit and bring your partner so they can sit in the room and feel it as well. Because realistically, the only other person you need to care about in your life, if it's going to stop you from making decisions, is your partner. Anyone else should never have a say in what you're doing. I don't care if you're a wog boy and you got your wogger mama and all the rest of stuff, and she's got an influence on your stuff. And by the way, I got heaps of wog mates. I grew up bloody playing soccer in Sydney. I have heaps of them, right? And my mum was very similar from that perspective as well. And it's just one of these things, like you got to block out everyone else's opinion. And if someone else's opinion is going to adversely affect you, don't bring it into your sphere. Mm. Leave it out of the sphere. Don't tell them what you're doing. Obviously, the only person that needs to know is the partner. And that's what I'm saying. If you need to get someone like your partner on board to take steps and to move things forward, and they're the only negative voice in your head. I've had clients that say to me, they'll listen in the car to Scouting Australia podcast and they'll put it at a really good spot just before their partner gets in and they'll play it. The partner will jump in. And I had this with a young girl, actually. I think she was mid-20s or something. And she was trying to get her partner on board. And she was driving in the car, picked up the partner from whatever it was, and she goes, oh, can I just leave this on for 5 minutes? This is in a really good spot right now. I just want to finish listening to this. And then she'd let us go on like a mad riff, like talking about something heaps, I don't know, heaps funny, heaps detailed, like that. And then she told me that. And then like a month later, we did this strategy. And she said, now they listen in bed at night as they go to sleep, listening to strategies and podcasts and shit. I was laughing. I was loving it. And I was like, that's so smart. Like the little things like that, like that. It's the only person she needs to convince is the partner that she needs to do it with. And realistically, and I love that, man. I love stories like that because, like, man, you need to have – that is probably the only person you need to have on board, you know. Outside of that, if you're very independent and they're okay with you just doing whatever, then that's fine. But if they're literally a stop point for you, then you need to do what you need to do to get them on board. But they're the only person I would worry about and try and get on. And hence why I reckon, you know, the summit is the environment. Things like the young lady did where she did the podcast side of things as well. Put it on at really good spots that you know your partner's probably going to like, but drag them along to this thing, to the summit, man, and get them amongst it, mate.
I love it, Sammy. Final question before we sign off from me. Where to from here? What is the next
laser focus on 500 retired clients by 2030? That is our absolute laser focus. And it's like I was saying before, if a client just kind of wants to come through and do a deal or whatever, we'll do a deal for a client. If a client really wants to come to and do one deal. But ultimately what we want and what we always look for and who we get excited to work with are the people who want to hit that goal. They want to retire by 2030 or sooner, or maybe they have a bigger goal and it's a little bit further, but they're committed to a result like that. Every day of the week, like I'm not a volume player. I don't want to advertise, sign on 1,000 clients, do 1,000 deals. I'd prefer to sign on 100 clients, do 10 deals with each of them, and it's the same volume of deals, but I have created a relationship with 100 people and taken them through to retirement and built that. I just think that is just amazing. Like thinking about that is it's the most amazing thing that I could think of from a business perspective is actually, imagine we do a summit in 2030 and everyone that has retired gets up on stage. You're fucking filling out a stadium. You know what I mean?
That's
how I think about this shit.
That's pretty powerful.
Yeah.
That was a goosebump sort of. I just had this visual of all these people and I just saw a whole bunch of smiles on people's faces and just that feeling.
Bro, you talked to me about endgame. Like what are we shooting for? We're not doing this just to be in business. Like obviously when you're in business to make money. All the guys are doing their things to, you know, within the business and all the rest of this sort of thing. But ultimately, man, we are laser focused on that result. Because I remember when I did my first cash flow deal for a lady, and she was a lady in her like her 60s or something. And I did a cash flow deal and I told her how much net per annum passive that deal was. And she started crying because it was like a quarter. She was making like 60 grand a year and the deal was like 15, 16 grand a year positive. She started crying. I started crying because I was just like, it was such an emotional moment because she's like, that's, I didn't think it was possible. And she bought these other things somewhere else. This was back in my first, it would be in 2020, right? In the second year of business, I did this deal. And man, it's just like those moments, you can't match that shit. You know what I mean? Like you get to a certain level of wealth. And I believe I'm actually past that now with the toys that I bought and the things that I've done. But you get to a certain level of wealth and a certain position where things don't have the same effect on you anymore. You don't get the same dopamine hit. You don't get the same, you know, buzz and excitement, adrenaline hit and all the rest of it. It's just life. You know what I mean? Stuff like that, it does not matter how many times it happens where a client will do something like that. There is that emotional pull that cannot be replicated by anything else. You cannot, there's nothing else that you can literally do that will give you that same emotional pull as something like that. So when people say, why do you still do it? Or, you know, it's not really it, you're just in it for business or whatever. You have a think about it. When you're seriously committed to goals like that, that will change people's lives. I think I look at it as well is because no one ever helped my parents with that. And I would have loved to have been able to go back 10 years ago and actually be able to put them on the trajectory that we are now. I think that's what always built it in me because I was a bit upset that I never could have helped them with it from that perspective. I tried to, but I wasn't confident enough to tell them to. You know what I mean? I tried to. I should have fucking told them to. And man, I think that's kind of what drives me on that side. Like I can just imagine people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, everything, 50s, 60s, all of them. Imagine that on the stage, big summit. The summit's now, we've almost sold, I don't know, we got guys, there's like not even that many tickets. I think there's 100, 150 tickets left on this thing. Imagine filling out half a stadium or something with people with that. You know what I mean? The stadium's there, but they're on the stage. They're fucking retired. Imagine that feeling. I don't know, man.
I love it. I love it. What a way to finish, Semi boy. Once again, on behalf of the entire community, congratulations on the award.
Thank you.
I know you don't do these things for the awards, but just reward for all of your hard work and the impact you've made in people's lives. That is the legacy that I think you can't put a price on. So congrats. Keep doing it.
Jimmy, mate, I appreciate it. This was a bit more of a raw ep, not the sort of thing we normally go into. So it was definitely a bit of a different
I'm glad we did it. So nah, thanks, mate, for sharing that. I know some of that stuff, you know, it's a little bit different, but I think it's very important.
Mate, you did well at kind of peeling the layers back and kind of getting me to that point where we got at the back end. It was cool to go deep on that stuff as well. Because sometimes, man, you got to reflect. It was like I was saying, work so much. Like sometimes you sit and reflect and see where you're really going with this stuff as well. Mate, I appreciate you coming in here and obviously running me through the sesh, man. So well done.
Well done to you.
You might get the MC job at the summit. We're going to put a poll. We'll put a poll.
Love your polls.
Mark Bruce is confirmed, bro.
Oh, here we go.
Mark Bruce is confirmed.
Right. Can't get Branson.
Not really, but Fair Bruce, enough. If you want to come on, can you give me a call?
What about D-Trump?
D-Trump. Nah, he asked, bro, but like, come on. It's too controversial.
He's not in favor.
Nah. Anyway.
Anyway.
Guys, thank you very much for tuning in. Thank you for being loyal and helping me get to the position of winning Buyer's Edge in the year as well. And a massive final thank you to my team and the team at APS for also helping put me on the trajectory to win Buyer's Agent of the Year as we have done. Massive thank you if you've tuned in to the very end of this episode. I hope you enjoyed the episode. If there's anyone you think you could take some great value out of today's episode, please send it on. Keep sharing the love. Keep talking, acting, thinking, doing property like us. If you haven't left us a 5-star review yet, please make sure you also jump on and leave us a 5-star review. If you have not hit the subscribe button, also whack that subscribe button and make sure you're tuning in for every episode. Jimmy, thank you once again for tuning in, mate. Listeners, thank you for tuning in. And until next week, guys, that's another Scouting Australia podcast.